This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is presented in cooperation with the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. We are continuing with the reading of the book by Judge Craig Brown entitled, A Fork in the Road. Last time we left off in Chapter 15, where Judge Brown is talking about coming to grips with the fact that he could not be independent anymore. He had to learn to live needing the help of others, and that included being a judge. He was saying, reasonable accommodation usually does not take very much. Over time, I have come to see myself not as disabled, but as differently abled. To be sure, I am a freak. As my late dad once said, I am sure that I stand out like a sore thumb. Fortunately, there are not many young blind people anymore. That is only a good thing. While I may be a freak to the sighted world because I am blind, I view that as their problem, not mine. I am not a victim. I once was, but not anymore. Neither are you. Whatever your tragedy or disability, you must keep the faith. You must do your best to expand what you can do instead of concentrating upon what you cannot. You must adapt both emotionally and physically to the challenges of your new circumstance. You must face the darkness of your situation squarely and honestly and go from there. Ultimately, we are all victims, but only if we remain so. You also need to be aware that the process of victimhood will repeat itself. Initially, when I retired in 2008, I was a mess. The changes in my routine were enormous. I had worked for 25 years, first as a lawyer and then as a judge, during which the court schedule dominated my routine. Blindness is dull. But dealing with people, other attorneys, and various issues kept me alive and kept me going. All of a sudden, that ended. Today I write, or rather dictate, from about 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day. I find it fulfilling, and I have discovered my purpose yet again. I did not expect my third career to be that of an author. It just worked out that way. Given some time, life usually works out. People change over time, but values and priorities remain constant. So, I am not a victim anymore, and neither are you. Chapter 16, Three Wise Men. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. Proverbs 1:5. Behçet's syndrome has flared in various parts of my body for more than 3 decades. Some of the flares were minor, such as skin lesions on my arms and legs. Some were more painful, such as the sores on my tongue. Some were located in more personal places, which made movement difficult. The various symptoms of Behçet's do not need to appear all at the same time. There were other symptoms that had developed that were not necessarily part of the disease process, but since I cannot explain it, I can only say that Behçet's is likely the probable cause. On Friday, September 15, 2009, I had some symptoms for the first time I could recall, such as my entire field of vision changing from black and various colors of gray to bright white and bright green. I found that symptom especially strange, since I have not seen any light since 2005. I had not been able to perceive color since 2002, either. Moreover, there were other strange and new aspects of the Behçet's constellation of symptoms. On the early morning of September 16, 2009, I felt a tingle above my right shoulder. Shortly thereafter, my left foot became entirely numb. Then a ribbon of pain moved from my right thigh down to my right foot. I do not have any rational explanation for these three symptoms, and, ultimately, they all disappeared. As I lay there early in the morning on September 16th, I became increasingly alarmed with what was happening. Never in my life had I dealt with anything like this. I was well aware that my delay in going to the hospital in 2006 was due to the dismissal of neurological symptoms that had never before occurred. Since they only lasted a short period of several days, I made the mistake of dismissing them. As a result of that choice and lack of information, we missed an opportunity to catch the progression of the sets early and prevent permanent damage. Afterwards, I made the decision that significant and/or bizarre new symptoms, which were substantial and in the end could not be explained, would result in my return to the emergency department at Duke University Medical Center. First, I went upstairs to my daughter Susanna's bedroom and told her where I was going, then called 911, explained my problem briefly, and summoned an ambulance. The ambulance arrived at my house without siren or lights flashing. In retrospect, since it was not emergency, I may take a cab next time, but I did not know that at the time, and just so you know, Susanna did not take me to the hospital because she had taken her sleeping medication. Since I'd been there before, I certainly knew what to expect when I got there. I explained my constellation of symptoms to the attendants. During the next hours, maybe nine, I met a number of Duke nurses, med students, residents, and staff. I was in my room in the emergency department alone, so I had plenty of time to think about matters, and since I have battled the disease for more than 30 years, I thought about these symptoms and where the disease process might be headed. While it was not a very subdued thought process, I thought it was an important thing to do to try to understand what was going on and what the symptoms meant. I have known that the onset of brain involvement with Behçet's is not a good sign, and I knew from past history that once the disease picked a part of the body, it usually struck again many times thereafter. On the basis of that, I suspected that I was going through my third onset of the symptoms since 2001. I also knew what repeated assaults on my brain by the disease would likely cause, and I did not need to say it for you to know. At about 10 a.m. the next morning, a nurse came into my room to announce that I had been discharged. She helped me get into a wheelchair and pushed me into the middle of the waiting room outside the emergency department. I detected no one around me. For a moment, I felt very isolated and very alone. Men are not supposed to cry, but years of therapy had taught me quite the opposite. For once, I did not contain my emotions, and frankly, given that power, I likely would not have chosen to anyway. They just erupted, and my chest heaved despite my best efforts to stay quiet. And I'm sure some of my quiet cries were overheard, and I'm sure that people there looked at me but said nothing because they were there in the privacy of their own medical issues and probably had some respect for what I was going through. For the most part, I was left alone until after I was done. As I calmed down, I heard the footsteps of three people approaching me. I had felt their presence before, but I felt it better a few minutes later and sensed that they were close to me. I knew they knew who I was because I heard one of them say my name to his friend. For some reason, at that time, I felt compelled to give a short history of why I was in the emergency department and, in a broad sense, what was going on. The man to my left seemed to be the leader of the group, which I surmised from the tone of his voice, how he spoke to his friends, and the fact that he spoke the most. He also had a staff or cane in his left hand. I heard it strike the floor lightly most of the time and with emphasis some of the time. The three men began praying in unison, their prayers quiet. I could not make out the words precisely, but the rhythm of it flowed like the Lord's Prayer, and I believe they were praying for me. I listened intently, and a quiet calm flowed over me. They collectively moved to my left, and I believe they paid a visit to the Duke staff. I heard the leader, it was the same voice I heard most often, tell the nurse who I was. They told the nurses I was a good man and had been a good judge. I gained some confidence from what I overheard and from other things they said. Almost immediately thereafter, a sheriff's deputy came by to say hello. I do not remember his name. It is not as if I was really focused. He asked how I was, and I told him I was fine. I was not, of course. I suspect he took one look at the remnants of tears on my cheeks, my Bichette's ravaged arms, and the electrode tape stuck to my legs, and knew I was not fine. I heard his voice crack when he told me he hoped I would feel better. A nurse popped out of the office to my right with a Kleenex and a telephone. I realized I had given my assistant, Zach, the wrong directions to pick me up at the emergency department and had asked for a phone to call a cab. She did it for me. Zach arrived a few minutes later, and we went back to my house. The larger point here is that you can find wisdom not just from three wise men, but also from one or two or more. The men can be your father, your grandfather, a brother, an uncle, a neighbor, a friend. Wise men are everywhere. There are many wise women, too. They can be your mother, your grandmother, a neighbor, an aunt, a sister, or friend. But one thing I find common with the wise is that they are usually older than you are, or rather their life experience runs deep into the heart, the soul, and the mind. Young people and even old ones sometimes act rashly, brashly, and do not consider the impact of their actions on those around them. Remember always that wisdom is all around you. You simply need to tap it. When you have a chronic illness, your body will often send signals that an attack is coming. You must learn how to recognize those signals and what they mean, and try to prevent the attack before it occurs. Since I caught my third neurological attack early, there was no permanent damage. Chapter 17, Our Sweet Surrender. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor demons, nor the present, nor the future, nor any powers, neither height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation, will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ our Lord. Romans 8:38-39. I will never give up. However, I recognize the reality of my medical situation. I have had three central nervous system attacks in the last 8 years. I will begin chemotherapy again as I write this chapter. God willing, that will work, or at least slow the progression of my friend, my illness. In the meantime, I do not intend to live my life like a dead man walking. I am grateful for the time I have had so far, and I rejoice in the positive steps that I have taken over time. For example, it was a minor miracle that I received my law degree and my master's degree on time, despite 14 medically related incompletes. It was a miracle, too, to practice law for 13 years and to become a judge for 12 years. I am grateful. Just look at the markers that I left behind already. Two books, The Creation and Evolution of TROSA, which has grown into the largest long-term drug facility in the southeastern United States. Or the development of the Criminal Justice Resource Center in Durham County, which serves more than 2,000 people in need every year. Or the creation and evolution of Drug Treatment Court. I am proud of these accomplishments in spite of it all and with the help of many people. When you look at my open letter to God in my blind train wreck chapter, you will see that most of my wishes have been granted. I am still here. I have accomplished a great deal with the help of others, and I intend to move forward still. The true measure of a man is the opportunity he makes and the other less fortunate people that he helps. I am grateful. My future in the physical sense is less certain. No one really knows. Always remember that a general prognosis does not necessarily apply to a specific case. In my own illness, I have noticed trend lines in each attack. A common thread seems to be that the skin ulcers and mouth, tongue, and gum ulcers appear before there is any neurological involvement, which means that I need to be on the lookout when that occurs. Before each of the neurological attacks, I ran a slight fever, and on the third attack, I took aspirin, which seemed to help, as well as prednisone sooner rather than later, so my third attack did not cause any damage. If you are terminally ill with cancer, you should be aware that all cancers are not created equal, since doctors now define cancers by types and prescribe treatments that fit the specific nature of each particular cancer. In many cases, cancer is no longer an automatic death sentence, which means that your life can be prolonged, even if it ultimately ends. Consider the effects of any proposed treatment in the context of the benefits that such a treatment will provide. If you have pancreatic cancer, which only has about a 6% chance of survival, 5 years after the fact, you may want to reject treatment altogether, since you are likely to pass on anyway. In the end, we all get to the same place. Every day to me now is a gift. So many of us take life for granted. I do not, and I cannot. I wish that I could, but the reality of my situation dictates a different answer. You will find your own in your own time. In the meantime, use your talents and your skills to help the less fortunate. They need your help more than you might need your own. Celebrate life. So often, we take that for granted, too. Rejoice in every sunrise and every sunset. Enjoy the people around you, your family, and the friends that you will make. Make some friendships last a lifetime. There will not be many, but they matter so much. Follow your heart. It is a better measure of a man than following your mind or reading a book. Learn from the old, since they know so much more about life than you do. Hear what they say, listen carefully, and take their lessons to heart. My health is not perfect, but I'm still here. I am blind, but I am still here. The bottom line is that I am still here. That is key. When I do give up, when the last ounce of fight is spent, I will ultimately surrender too. We all do. But there will be a smile on my face and the joy of a long battle fought hard with many victories, but ultimately a final loss. Remember always that life is patience and everything takes time. My journey is becoming more difficult. I will fight my illness to my last breath. I will never give up, and I will never surrender. That is, until my sweet surrender. Chapter 18. Living with Your Chronic Monster. Smooth seas do not make skillful sailors. An African proverb. Adversity is a fact of life. It cannot be controlled. What we can control is how we react to it. Anonymous. So you just got the bad news. You have a chronic illness. A chronic illness can last a lifetime and needs to be managed medically. Effective chronic disease control requires attention to social, behavioral, environmental, and clinical aspects. Nearly one in two Americans, 133 million, have a chronic medical condition of one kind or another, and chronic illness accounts for nearly 70% of all deaths in the United States. However, most of these people are not actually disabled, as their medical conditions do not impair normal activities. The first thing you need to do in this modern age is hit the internet, read about it, and define your monster. What are the short, medium, and long-term implications of your illness? How fast does it progress? And what turns does it take? If it cannot be prevented or stopped, can modern medicine slow the disease down? Is there anything that you can do, such as a change in diet, losing weight, or getting regular exercise, that might help your overall state of health? The most common chronic conditions include high blood pressure, arthritis, respiratory diseases like emphysema, and high cholesterol. Some of these examples of common conditions are asthma, chronic fatigue syndrome, hepatitis, autoimmune diseases, osteoporosis, and in some cases, cancer. Many chronic illnesses progress over time, usually in small steps. You need to know the potential prognosis and path of your chronic illness. But in doing so, always remember that a general prognosis does not necessarily apply to a specific case. There are always exceptions to the general rule. If your chronic illness recurs, instead of being constant, learn to watch for the warning signs that often occur before your next episode. You are the one ultimately responsible for managing your chronic illness. Work with your doctors on a regular basis and ask them many questions about anything that you do not understand. Depending on the nature of your chronic illness, you may also be working with multiple medical specialists who need to work together to get you the best health care treatment for your condition. Make sure that your health care team talks to each other. If your chronic illness is serious, you may need to consider the psychological impact of the disease process on you. The more severe the impact of the chronic illness, the more likely it is that you will suffer from depression as you face the monster's attack. Recognize up front the 5 stages that you will pass through in dealing with your monster: anger, denial, depression, grief, and acceptance. Some people will breeze through these stages quickly. Some people who are stubborn, like me, have yet to reach full acceptance. Learn the symptoms that often come before the onset of your chronic illness. For an example, an asthma attack will often have multiple triggers before it occurs. With diabetes, the onset of low or high blood sugar will have physical symptoms as well. By catching symptoms early, you may be able to prevent permanent damage from the attack yet to come. Depending upon the nature of the destruction caused by your monster or your resulting disabilities, you need to face the reality of retraining and rehabilitation. For example, someone suffering from paralysis following a stroke will need physical therapy and follow through with recommended exercises thereafter. If you lost your hearing, you may need a hearing aid and a hearing implant, or you may have to learn to read lips or attend school for the deaf. If you are going blind, you will need to attend extensive residential rehabilitation and training. The nature of the rehabilitation depends upon the nature and extent of the disability. Given the nature of the disability, you will have to learn how to do things differently. Someone who has difficulty walking will need to learn how to use a cane, a walker, a scooter, or a wheelchair. If you can no longer use your right arm, you will have to learn to train your left arm to do those things that your right arm once did. You should ask your doctors and rehabilitation specialists how to do these things in your own situation, but do not stop there. The best source of information comes from those who have already been through it. If you're going blind, ask a more experienced blind person how he or she did it. If you're going deaf, ask a deaf person how they made the transition. Your brethren are very happy to help you. In many ways, they can offer more practical information than the professionals. I believe that everybody wants to live as long as possible with the greatest quality of life. Over my 34 years of medical treatment for Behçet syndrome, I have developed 10 rules for the management of any chronic medical condition. You need to develop your own rules, given your own situation. Rule 1 is to have the same doctor for as long as possible, if the right circumstances present themselves. Most doctors will get familiar with your health care issues over time. This is better than having a series of doctors learning about you by reading your file or asking you quick questions during a 10 to 15 minute appointment. Rule 2 is to listen to your doctors, pay attention to what they have to say to you and what it means for you, and follow through. I did not always do that, either then or even now. In life, there is always a learning curve. I think I got it, finally, when the big hit occurred in 2006. At that time, I realized that I had absolutely had no time to play with any aspect of the healthcare situation. None. I did not like the fact that I had no choice in this matter, but as my mom always said, it is what it is. I had to deal with every aspect of it without exception for the remainder of my life. The bottom line is Rule 3. You have to follow your doctor's instructions and maintain your overall good health. Take your medication as prescribed. If a particular medication is not working or its effectiveness is diminished over time, let your doctor know. You need to take the best medication that works for you. Also, make sure that you follow through on your physical therapy and rehabilitation. You need to see your doctors on a regular basis to check on the status of your chronic illness to make sure that it is not getting worse. The state of your general health may play an important role in stopping or slowing down the progression of your chronic illness. You need to eat the right foods on a daily basis and to avoid foods that are high in sugar, cholesterol, or fat. If you are smoking, you need to stop. You need to get regular exercise, preferably on a daily basis. Strong overall health will help the nature of your chronic illness in many cases. Rule 4 is that you as a patient get to make the call. Listen to your doctors, ask them lots of questions, and make the best possible judgment you can under the circumstances. You may not like the choices, but you as a patient are stuck with the realities of your informed choice. Rule 5 is that with some chronic illnesses, you may not get to choose where to live. If you have a serious chronic illness, you may not be able to get the best medical care for it in a small or medium-sized city. Like it or not, common sense may require you to live near a major medical facility to get the best treatment. My odds are getting better, not worse, because of the choice I made in where I lived after I completed my education. Choosing to live in Durham, North Carolina, placed me close to the highly rated Duke Eye Center and the Duke University Medical Center. Rule 6 is the critical importance of strong family support when facing a serious or chronic medical condition or crisis. My mom and dad were always there and always willing to talk me through the difficulties. When I graduated law school and graduate school in 1983, there were many things that I did not fully understand, fully appreciate, or much care for, but I always had Dad to talk to me about everything that upset me. Friends are also absolutely essential. Mine got me through this, and I am forever grateful. Yours will too. Years after I lost my eyesight, I attended a Duke Eye Center board function, which Dr. Matchemer also attended, and I asked him why he had not sent me to therapy sooner. He paused for a second, perhaps to fill his wine glass. You weren't ready. That is rule number 7. You must be ready to acknowledge and accept help for whatever life throws at you, especially if it is bad. The nature and extent of the assistance that you need depends on your individual situations. Rule 8 is not to be afraid. Given the nature of my illness, I was always afraid to go to neurology because I knew that the onset of neurological symptoms was not a good sign. If I had done so before the big hit in 2006, I would have learned the neurological symptoms to watch for that indicated the onset of neurological involvement. Had I known them, I would have sought medical treatment 4 to 5 days earlier than I did, thereby increasing my chances of a better outcome. Rule number 9 is that a good sense of humor helps in a tight situation. It relieves the tension in those around you for a moment so that you can focus on the problems at hand. I am lucky to have been blessed with a dry Iowa sense of humor. Since doctors deal with serious medical situations on a daily basis, they appreciate humor too. Rule number 10 is easy. Never give up and never lie down. You will feel like giving up from time to time. We all do. but you and I do not have a choice in the matter. There are too many people counting on us in one way or another. Besides, giving up is also dull and boring, and a good fight can be a good thing. You will have plenty of time to lie down after you pass on, and we all die in due course. You do not need to agree with my rules in your own case. You need to think about it in the context of your own healthcare situation and life experience. If you do it well, the way you fight and the way you die will leave as big a mark on your family and friends as the life you have led. These 10 rules will serve you well in the healthcare crisis and even in most other crises. They are my top 10 rules, and you will develop your own. As in any good textbook, I summarize the 10 rules below. Number 1. Have the same doctor for as long as you can. Continuity is important. Number 2. Listen to your doctors. Pay close attention to what they have to say. Number 3. Follow your doctor's instructions. Take your medication. Follow through with any other recommendations, such as physical therapy or rehabilitation, and maintain overall good health. Number 4. As a patient, you get to make the call. Number 5. Sometimes with a chronic health condition, you do not get to choose where to live. Number 6. The support of family and friends is critically important when facing a chronic medical condition. Number 7. Be ready for what life throws at you, especially if it is bad. Number 8. Do not be afraid. Well, maybe a little afraid. And ask doctors a lot of questions to make certain they understand your situations. Doctors like questions. Number 9. A good sense of humor relieves tension in this tough situation. And number 10, do not give up and do not lie down. Chapter 19, Surviving Your Train Wreck. Everyone fights their monsters, survives their train wrecks, continues on their journey, and hits a fork in the road. The author. Everyone has problems, and everyone will fight their own monsters and have at least 3 train wrecks. My blind train wreck and my 34-year battle with the Bichette's monster are extreme examples. But in addition to those train wrecks, I have also had at least 6 others: the death of my mom and dad, my retirement, 2 divorces, and my total disability. In addition to these train wrecks, as a Durham County District Court judge, I heard more than 100,000 cases, a number of which involved other monsters in our society, such as loss of employment, alcohol and substance abuse, and mental health issues. Train wrecks are more common than you might imagine. Since it is your life, you get to define what your train wreck is and what to do about it. But I have a few suggestions below. To start out with, there is the death of your mother and your father. That is a train wreck that all of us will face in due time. We all need to get prepared sometime before that train wreck occurs, if we can. Honor them while they are still here. You do not have to build a statue or name a monument after them to do so. It can be as simple as a daily phone call, a card that is meaningful on their birthday, a traditional family dinner, or going to their favorite event. When they pass, you need to save something from their lives to remind you of their legacy and to pass on to your children. Every parent, whatever his or her faults in life, usually did something right with his or her children, and it will always help you to be reminded of that. Before your mother or father pass, they should visit their local funeral home to make their final arrangements. They should also meet with their family and or ministers to discuss their funeral services, select their method of burial, and make arrangements for interment for their ashes or for selection of their cemetery plot and headstone. Parents need to prepare their own obituary in advance, since that would otherwise be left to the family, who will need to hastily prepare such an obituary in their grief after the death of the parent. If the parent or parents can afford it, they should think about prepaying a chunk of their funeral expenses. If they cannot afford to do so, they should consider purchasing burial insurance, which is usually inexpensive and can be obtained through many employers, the internet, or your local insurance agent. Burial insurance is inexpensive, usually only about $10 or $20 a month. By purchasing or making their selection early, the family will avoid having to make difficult and more expensive choices at the worst possible times when they are grieving their loved one. When my mom and dad died, the funeral director tried to sell us extras, which would, of course, increase his profit margin. But we said no thank you, since our parents had never selected or approved the expense when they were alive. If your loved one is being cremated, you do not need to buy a casket, since you will not be using it for burial. You can just rent it instead for the viewing and the funeral. The funeral home will be happy to oblige, since they will make money either way, and they can use the casket again for someone else. Many families have ongoing disputes between siblings or other relatives or divorced spouses that have lingered for many years. As your parents or parent grows older, it may be a good time to bury the hatchet. You should move on anyway, since your future never lies in the past, but up in the road ahead. No one is asking you to become friends with the other party to a dispute, or join hands with them, or sing kumbaya, or much less have dinner together. Just start being civil with each other. In many family disputes, children are often put in the middle because they love both sides. Your children will always appreciate forgiveness because even as young adults, they grow tired of being stuck in the middle. In my experience as a family court judge for more than 10 years, women have often seemed to harbor more anger, bitterness, and hatred toward their spouse than men did. In such situations, it may be necessary for the men in the family to rise to the occasion of forgiveness and bring them along. With this book, I am extending my hand to my ex-wife Meredith and her family, and to my ex-wife Catherine and her family as well. I ask them to forgive my trespasses, and I in turn will forgive theirs. My own children, Laura and Susanna, are tired of being put in the middle since they love both Meredith, myself, and their grandparents. The time is now to end it because none of us will be here forever, and the slate needs to be cleaned before our children's children come to be. I'm not looking for miracles, but just the burying of the hatchet so we can at least be civil to each other in public. Catherine was a stepmother to my children for more than a decade during some of their most difficult times. She is welcome to see them for the right reasons, so long as my children believe that her relationship with them is positive. If you live long enough, everyone retires, which is the next most common train wreck. By planning for retirement in advance, you will ease the transition, since retirement will change many of your daily routines and end regular contact with your colleagues at your place of employment or business. When I left the courthouse after retiring for medical reasons, I was surprised that very few of my friends or colleagues ever picked up the telephone. You should expect that because people move on with their lives, which means that you need to plan your retirement, which is now your life. Stay busy by volunteering, pursuing a hobby, working in your community or your church, visiting with your true friends, and keeping up with your family and your children better, since you may not have had much time to do so before. Pursue new interests to challenge yourself, which will stimulate both mind and spirit. Take the time to read and reflect, since you have more time to do so. The Chinese respect their elders. In the United States, we send the elderly to a retirement center or a nursing home rather than dealing with their needs and problems directly. We would learn a great deal from the American Indians, Asians, and other Hispanic cultures about how to better treat our oldest citizens. The loss or change of employment now occurs on a much more frequent basis than it did for our parents, many of whom worked for the same employer for 30 years and then retired. Today, it is not uncommon to have two, three, or more careers in a lifetime, which means that you need to change to fit your education, economic circumstances, and the availability of employment near to where you live. If you are changing careers, you might obtain vocational training at your local employment security office, community college, or university. Pursue your interests and talents when selecting a new career, since you will likely perform best in an area that you both enjoy and excel in. Since changes in employment and multiple careers are the norm these days, prepare for the change by obtaining additional education or training that will best prepare you. If you think about it ahead of time and prepare for it, a change in employment does not need to be a train wreck. Losing your job as a result of a layoff or being fired is more difficult. You may not have much warning with a layoff, or you will not have much time to think about your future career and the training or education that might be required. Sudden termination or being fired is even more traumatic, since you have had even less time to make a mid-course correction. If you are being terminated by your employer, ask if you can resign and get a good or neutral recommendation from them for your next employer. Resignation always looks better than termination for cause. If you are fired for a reason, learn from your mistakes. You may need to change your conduct in the future by arriving to work on time on a regular basis, doing your job well, being appropriately dressed, or being respectful to your superiors, among other things. If you are fired, accept responsibility for your termination and explain to your future employers what you will do differently. Always keep your head up, because most difficult situations turn if you approach them in a positive manner. Since more than half of all marriages fail, regrettably, divorce is another very common train wreck. I've had two divorces myself, and I have heard thousands of domestic cases, so I know a little bit about the subject. Whether it is friendly or not, no divorce is easy. If it is nasty, the human heart is ripped wide open and blood spills all over the floor, which in turn results in bitterness, which in turn poisons the soul. While I know it is difficult in the heat of the moment, the husband and wife in a bitter divorce proceeding need to look forward rather than backwards, because their relationship is over. While the blame game may create a winner and a loser, it rarely helps any party move forward, much less process their own mistakes so that they can avoid them in the next relationship and heal. Whether they realize it or not, both sides bear responsibility. If the parties have children, the blame game especially needs to be avoided. A snide remark by one parent about the other parent in front of a child is like hitting the child in the head, because all children love their parents unconditionally. Wherever possible, a child needs both a mother and a father in their lives. As a judge, I was always in favor of joint custody over separate custody when it was appropriate. Every child needs to see their father, whether he is paying child support or not. Some parents often use their children as weapons to get back at their children's other parent by denying visitation for bogus reasons. I have changed custody from one spouse to the other when one spouse blocked visitation on a frequent basis for no good reason. It is difficult enough for a child to grow up these days. While the mother or father may hate each other for good reasons, the spouses in every bitter domestic case need to put down their weapons and focus their best efforts on the business of raising their children well. If you hire a lawyer to represent you in a domestic case, you need to make sure that the lawyer's personality and approach matches your own. A client needs to listen carefully to the goals of every attorney in their case, as well as to the law and the realities of going to court. Make sure that any attorney that you hire gets along with the attorney for your spouse, because if they despise each other, they will fight more battles than is necessary at your expense. Avoid lawyers that use the discovery process where it is not necessary in an effort to run up the bill. Ask your attorney what is the point of every pleading, motion, written questions, and depositions, and ask if there is a less expensive method to obtain the same information. Provide your attorney with all information and documentation requested, because if the attorney has to do it, it will cost you more. Make sure that your attorney has the time and interest to do your case, because repeated delays are expensive, and that expense is paid by you. If he will not return your phone call, send him a letter or email. If he continues to ignore you, threaten to fire him first. If that fails to get a response, fire him and obtain other counsel, or threaten to file a state bar grievance, or both. When it comes to a courtroom hearing, be aware that most hearings are now on videotape, which is reduced to a CD and readily available to any member of the public, which means that your enemies, business competitors, employer, or other candidates seeking the same promotion as you could potentially have access. If the spouse is charged with adultery, you may want to settle the case privately, since your marital misconduct, however human, might be seen as evidence of your poor character. If you have litigation that involves the division of marital property, you will have to file a written affidavit that will disclose all of your assets and liabilities for the world to see, as well as verify documents. Your enemies or business competitors might really enjoy this information, and since it is public, they are entitled to get a copy. A DVD of the courtroom proceedings or the court file costs less than 50 cents per copy. When your children turn age 18, they can get copies too. So, unless you absolutely have to go to court, you should avoid it at all costs, unless you want to undress yourself before the world. Use private mediation instead, and be reasonable with your offers or counteroffers to the other side. If both parties do not much care for the settlement, it is probably a good one. Do not go after something just because you can, because the other party may have little choice but to give in, which later plants a seed of resentment. If there is the problem of substance abuse and alcoholism, I know a little bit about that too, since substance abuse is a common thread in about 80% of all criminal cases. The problem is more common than you think, since most addicts try to hide it. A good first step that everybody should take might be to see if they have the addiction gene. While there is no specific process to determine that yet, if your mother or father or any of your siblings have had an alcohol problem, you have a 4 times greater chance of becoming an alcoholic yourself. In that situation, you might not want to take your first drink or keep your drinking very light, since you may not be able to stop. If your parents or other brothers or sisters are heavy users or addicted to drugs, although the chances are not as high as with alcohol abuse, there is still a greater likelihood that you might carry the addiction gene too. But genetic predisposition does not guarantee addiction, since it appears that more than 50% of the cause is environmental. If you choose to use marijuana and one of your close family members is a drug addict, you might want to limit your use to occasional use only and to avoid chronic use altogether. You do not need to try super addictive drugs like methamphetamines or crack cocaine, because studies have shown that more than 25% of all people who take just one hit are addicted thereafter. If you are at greater risk for substance abuse, you need to take precautions and be on the lookout for the train wreck before it happens. While marijuana may not be very harmful, someone with the addiction gene is more likely to step up to the next level. The same is true for alcohol, in the sense that there may be no way to control the leap from light to moderate to heavy drinking. If you are careful, you can see some train wrecks ahead before they occur. If you have a chronic drug or alcohol problem, you need to get some help. But realize that it is easier said than done, since most people never have to admit that they have a problem. No temporary treatment works best without lengthy aftercare. While most of our judges send multiple DWI offenders and drug addicts to prison, that is not the best long-term response to the problem, since prison rarely provides any aftercare. While the prison solution is necessary in some cases to get the defendant's attention and protect the public, it is often done for the wrong reasons, to get the judge reelected by making the public feel safer. But since our prisons rarely deal with the underlying problems, poor education, substance abuse, mental illness, and lack of adequate job training, 70% of all people released from prison return within the next 3 years. One definition of insanity is doing the same thing on a routine basis, but expecting a different result. The system needs to change because it is not working. We need to change our prisons to provide greater rehabilitation for offenders, such as better educational opportunities, substance abuse treatments with aftercare, job training, and mental illness counseling. We need to find a way to hold the defendants accountable after they are released from prison. A number of small but significant changes will make the system better. All DWI offenders sent to prison need to be monitored by an alcohol monitoring bracelet after the release. Since their alcohol addiction costs them $10 to $12 per day to pay for the alcohol, they need to pay for a chunk of the alcohol monitoring expense going forward. It now costs about $10 per day for an alcohol monitoring bracelet, and the unit cost will fall further as more bracelets are used. When the bracelets can detect cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines, and other common illegal drugs, which will be coming sooner than you think, their use needs to be expanded to include other drug addicts as well. The monitoring also needs to be complemented by the regular use of Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous as aftercare treatment, which can be verified. Many times alcoholism and the use of controlled substances occur together. This fact means that all DWI offenders should present their criminal history as well as their traffic history to the presiding judge at the time that they are found or plead guilty, so that the presiding judge can get a full view of their polysubstance abuse, which may require different and longer treatment than alcohol alone. Likewise, criminal offenders with a history of substance abuse should be required to present their traffic history as well, for the same reason. Substance abuse or alcohol treatment of any kind should be followed by lengthy aftercare. If treatment does not work the first time, ramp it up. Start with outpatient treatment first, then short-term inpatient treatment, followed by longer-term inpatient treatment if necessary. The treatment of addiction should be appropriate for the level of addiction, and you should move up to the continuum of care as necessary. To be a recovered person, you need to be clean for at least 5 years. The issue of mental illness is more difficult because of the stigma that is attached to the mentally ill. No one likes mental illness, but it probably is associated with 40 to 50% of all drug addiction, which means that you cannot treat one problem without the other. All chronic alcoholics or drug addicts should be screened for mental illness. Anyone who is mentally ill, especially if they are bipolar, depressed, or have a mood disorder, should be put on notice that they are at much greater risk for alcoholism and drug addiction. When you think about it, that really is not very surprising. Most mentally ill people do not feel very good about themselves, and the use of alcohol and drug makes them feel better, if only for a while. Also, some mentally ill people do not take their medications as described, since their medication does not make them feel very good. So, how do we pay for even these modest changes given the reality of most state budgets that face substantial shortfalls? While most states are in budgetary shambles, I do not believe that across-the-board budget cuts are appropriate, since parts of the budget can better handle cuts than others. Instead of slashing government services to the bone to make the budget balance, we need to increase revenue from people that are using the system by means of testing their access to state services. A rich person needs to pay more than a poor person for state services. I will give you a personal example. Every portable handicap sticker now costs $5, but I am not your average handicapped person. I can afford to pay more. We can also set up an individual surcharge that would be structured to close the budget gap. While the poorest of the poor may only be able to afford $5 a month, That is still $60 a year. The surcharge would rise commensurate with your income and rise further than the 7% maximum income tax with individuals who earn much higher income. You could reduce the surcharge during bad times, increase it during good times, or eliminate it altogether once the budget gap is closed by other more traditional sources of revenue. There are lots of ways to increase revenue outside of standard income taxes, and we may need to use a variety of tools to meet the problem head on. We may need to set up a staggered payment system for every state service where it is cost-effective to do so. Our citizens might have to carry their last federal income tax return in their wallet to provide proof of income. While I do not care much for that choice, since everyone carries their driver's license, their birth certificate, and their Social Security card already, the failure to provide income verification with a tax return will simply mean that you will pay the highest price to get in. I am sure that the IRS could come up with some short-form method that will provide such verification with a minimum of intrusion into an individual's life. Since I am 100% disabled by my blindness, I know something about disability, too. Disability is tough because it can change everything. Total disability is the most difficult because it requires fundamental changes to your life. Since I could no longer read, drive a car, or get around with ease, I had to find different ways to get the same information, obtain transportation, and to use a cane to protect myself when I moved on the ground. If you have a serious brain injury, you may need to learn how to talk again or move your arms and legs or any other bodily function that used to be easy to do. Anyone who is faced with total disability, especially if it is sudden, will suddenly confront depression. Total disability will also change the dynamics in any close relationship with another person, since they will be required to help you on a regular basis. Your disability may require you to change your employment, and some of your friends will no longer be your friends because dealing with you is more difficult. Your own approach to your disability sets the stage for how others view your disability. Remember that everyone is afraid of disability, since disability may happen to them. Obtain some necessary retraining and talk to others who suffer from the same disability, since they may have many practical suggestions to give you that will help you survive the train wreck. If you cannot work anymore, you should consider Social Security Disability Assistance, which is why it is there in the first place. If you can still work, do so, because any positive routine will keep your spirits up as well as your confidence, since you are still useful to others. If you cannot work, find something to do with your time that is meaningful, because it means that you will be less bored or anxious, which usually means that you will be happier. Involve other people that are close to you in your disability, since you cannot face it alone. Under any circumstance, always do your best, because disability is not just a train wreck, but it represents a major fork in the road. Since any disability makes common tasks more difficult, learn patience and focus on what you can still do rather than what you cannot. Americans might learn a great deal from the American Indians, Asians, and Hispanic culture in terms of how they deal with their disabled. Families handle these issues on a family basis and very rarely place their loved ones in a retirement center or group home, since their families will take care of them. By contrast, in the United States, we seem to herd our elderly, disabled, and mentally ill into a program outside the family structure. While the American Disabilities Act was a major step forward for the disabled, the fact remains that the disabled are treated differently than others. When I was sighted, I remember diverting my eyes when a disabled person approached me, and I'm sure that practice still continues. Maybe instead of looking away, which implies that the disabled do not exist, you might greet them warmly, ask them how they are doing, and mean it, and help them in any way possible. The disabled are just like you and the way I used to be. But from personal experience, I can tell you that disability often leaves the disabled feeling isolated and alone.
This has been Bob Martin,
for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared in cooperation with the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. We will be back next week with a continuation of A Fork in the Road by Craig Brown.